Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, this week we are talking two different bolognese recipes with our very own Andy Baragani. First up is BA's best bolognese, the most streamlined version of this classic dish that admittedly still takes some time so that it reaches a state of perfection. And then there is our cauliflower bolognese, a vegetarian riff on the dish that subs in cauliflower and mushrooms for the ground meat. After that, I sit down with Basically editor Emil Stonick and our social media whiz Emily Schultz to go through a package in our March issue, A Beginner's Guide to Buying and Enjoying Wine. All right, let's do this. Here is Andy Baragani. Andy Bolognese Baragani, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's been a minute.
It has. Listen, I'm going to get right to it. You know how much I love bolognese.
I do know. I think we all know at BA that you love bolognese.
but so do you, right?
I do love bolognese. I think we both have a lot of opinions, a lot of shared opinions. I think everybody has their thoughts on this iconic dish, and I think we did it justice.
It's funny because when you were developing the recipe for BA's best bolognese, I wanted to argue with you more than I was able to because, like, weirdly, we were almost on the exact same frequency,
yes.
But you're the one who had actually develop the recipe, and when you're developing the recipe, you have to go through all the steps and measure and do all those things that we home cooks kind of don't do. But you're like, if this is going to go on the site, in the magazine, I've got to get it right.
I kind of forgot how this even came up. Was it your idea or my idea where we didn't have a BA's best bolognese?
I think I brought up the issue that there wasn't like a basic bolognese and one that didn't have to be like laboriously time-consuming but still took the requisite amount of time to coax out the most flavor and texture, et cetera, of this sort of iconic sauce. So So from a recipe developer standpoint, where did you start with a recipe like this? Like, what's square one?
Well, I did my research. I definitely had made a few different versions of bolognese. I made one where I would hand cut the beef. I did ones with different amounts of pork fat in the form of bacon or guanciale or pancetta. I've done versions with red wine versus white wine. And then I just kind of started researching the classics from Marcello Hazan, Paul Bertoli, Alice Waters, Silver Spoon, and saw what I thought made sense, what I agreed with, what I didn't agree with, and then kind of brought that all together and came up with my own version, or our own version.
Yes.
For BA's best bolognese.
So one thing I think where a lot of people, I guess you could say there's a misconception, kind of like the quote-unquote meat sauce that a lot of us grew up with, like in the 70s or 80s. What's interesting about bolognese is there's actually very little tomato involved.
Very little tomato. I actually don't want any fresh tomato or canned tomato. The only form of tomato I want in my bolognese is tomato paste.
So it infuses that with that sort of rich umami tomato flavor, but not like tomato saucy. So
exactly.
So if not that, like, so walk us through it. Like, where do you start with the bolognese?
I start with pork fat. So I render out pancetta. I chose pancetta with this recipe just because I love the flavor. If you really can't find it, you can use bacon, no biggie. And
But not smoked bacon.
Not smoked bacon.
Yeah.
And then I just take some thinly sliced pancetta, just chop it up really fine, and then I render it in a dry pan.
Pancetta you can find at most, you know, markets, Italian markets, and you can just tell the guy behind the counter, like, yeah, give me a half inch, and
exactly,
they'll just cut it through that log of pancetta, and it's like Italian unsmoked bacon.
Exactly.
But cured.
Easy. And there's already so much fat, it's unnecessary to add any additional fat in the form of olive oil.
And so you'll chop it up, or?
I'll chop it up, Finely chop, add it to a dry pan, and then put it to like medium heat and let it render slowly. So you get all that fat out of the pancetta, and then until it becomes nice and crisp, scoop that out, and then I add my sofrito or mirepa, which is a mix of onion, carrot, and celery that's you can finely chop yourself. I just add all of it to a food processor and then pulse it up.
I think you would want it actually not quite pureed, but you don't want it big chunks, right?
I don't want you to see the carrots.
Yeah.
I don't want you to see the onion. I don't want you to see the celery. That's why I choose a food processor.
And so it all becomes one mixture.
Exactly. Almost where it's a paste.
Yeah.
Just extremely fine. I add that to the pan with that has the rendered fat, and then I cook that down. I don't necessarily brown it. I just get it really, really soft and cooks out. And then once that happens, That's when I add the ground meat.
Okay, so let's talk meat. So obviously you need meat in a bolognese. We had talked about this once on a podcast with Carl about meatballs. Are we doing beef? Are we doing the whole beef pork veal thing? Or what did you experiment with that?
When it came to the pork, I didn't necessarily want to use ground pork, but I wanted to use a pork product, as in a salty pork product, whether that, again, guanciale, pancetta, or bacon. In regards to the actual meat, I just thought I wanted to go with beef, just regular good old chuck. I skipped the veal. I didn't want people to buy a piece of meat where they had to chop it themselves. Like
that's
I've done
insane.
In the
you
past.
Did that one day. Why? What were you doing?
You know, I did that one day. I did that because it's based off a Paul Bertolli recipe where he takes a skirt steak and he hand chops it. It's like 1/8-inch diced skirt steak, and what you get is this incredible texture.
That is such a wannabe chef thing to do. I don't mean him. I mean you being the wannabe chef.
And it's, well, the thing is, like, I think I did this maybe 10 years ago, like, once in a blue moon have made it since. But it's amazing. You get this incredible texture to it, and you really taste the meat. But with this, I went with ground meat. Once you kind of render the pancetta fat and all that, that's when I actually add the meat to that. So hold on the sofrito. I jumped a step. So when you cook out your pancetta, you have the crispy bits, you remove that, and then you're going to add little, like, golf ball-sized pieces of ground meat to the pan.
Wait. So you do the sofrito after the ground beef?
Yes.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah. So you're peeling off little balls?
Little golf ball chunks? Size, yeah, little chunks.
So you're not just throwing it all in there at once. And you're calling for this for 1 pound, which is not that much, but it's like a little...
And you're not trying to brown the meat too hard. You just have these little clumps of meat, and it just gets a little bit of color in spots. It's probably pink in the center. Mm-hmm. It'll be gray and brown in some spots, and that's it. It's going to finish cooking in the sauce.
So I'm not breaking it up and smashing it up?
No, that'll happen later.
Okay, so now I've got these little golf balls. I like the golf analogy. Do I remove those now?
You remove the balls.
Okay.
Add the sofrito. Cook that down. And then you add your pancetta and your meat back into the pot. Okay. That's when you start smashing the meat.
Okay.
And I don't brown the meat too hard, because if you brown ground meat really hard, it becomes like this dry rubber band.
Just kind of pebbly.
Yes. Not so good. And then once you got that going, I add 1 cup white wine.
So this is another thing. I think people who haven't made bolognese before, because it's like, what we kind of think of as a red sauce type sauce. You're like, oh, well, if I'm going to order pasta bolognese, I'm going to get a nice bottle of Chianti or Barbera or whatever. But we're adding white wine.
I like white wine. I think a lot of the recipes, they went both ways. I saw recipes that use red or white. I like white just because you already have a lot going on with the pancetta, with ground meat, tomato paste. I wanted something a little bit more delicate. Yeah. And I just think it lets everything else kind of shine through.
It's a bit subtler. Yeah. Sometimes you get, like, you know, if you got like a Barolo or something, it's like it's too assertive. You know, it makes too much of a statement. Mm-hmm. And in your case, you just want to bring in some fruity acid and
some good acidity.
Yeah.
And when I add that wine, at this point, it's on like medium low heat.
Oh, that low, okay.
Yeah, really low. And it takes about 20 minutes, I believe, for it to cook down. It doesn't happen in like 4 or 5 minutes. It's really, really slow, because I don't want anything on medium high once I add all those components together. The meat, the sofrito, and the pancetta, I want everything to just cook really low and slow.
So this is not like one of those like restaurant cook recipes where you're on a fiery hot stove and flames everywhere.
If there's one big thing to take away from this recipe, is just like, go really slow with
Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
You got nothing to do.
Absolutely. Don't try to be making this on a Monday. Once you add the wine and it has cooked off, that's when I add...
Is there a way you know that it's cooked off?
When the pan is pretty much dry.
Okay. Yeah. So you're looking. Okay.
Exactly. And then I add 1/3 cup tomato paste. This is the ingredient that I played with the most. It started with 2 tablespoons. Then it went to 1/4 cup. Then I went to 1/3 cup. And I wanted... What I was doing with that is I was trying to achieve, one, the right color. It needed to be, I didn't want it to look like a red sauce, but it needed to have the right color. I didn't want it to be too brown, and I wanted the sauce to impart good acidity from the tomato paste, and I wanted that umami flavor. And so it could take up to 1/3 cup tomato paste.
And when you add tomato paste to this or any sort of stew, like, you want the tomato paste to cook a little bit,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. This takes about, sometimes if it's a small amount, it takes maybe 3 minutes to cook down. This goes for 6 to 8 minutes, and it just will darken. That's how you know, and it'll start to stick to the pot.
Yep.
That's when you know it's ready to keep going. From there, I add a bay leaf. I like a bay leaf in my bolognese. I think it's one of those secret ingredients. Yeah, a fresh bay leaf does wonders. I swear, laurel bay, if you could find it.
Maxine Rappaport, when I was growing up, she was throwing a bay leaf in everything. I'm like, why do we need the bay leaf, Mom?
This is, I promise you, one of the most streamlined, simple versions of this.
You throw a bay leaf in.
A bay leaf in. And then I add some freshly grated nutmeg. I like nutmeg in my bolognese. I don't think that's too much to ask. I think it should have a bit of...
That's kind of a very northern Italian thing, right?
I didn't know that, but...
But you also see it with like the cream dish, like a bechamel sort of base sauces and whatnot. Yeah, you'll see the grated nutmegs in
there. I think it does wonder. You shouldn't necessarily taste the nutmeg, but it's just enough to kind of be like,
this is... It's also like if you make a good homemade mac and cheese, there's often a little nutmeg in there.
Yes, it does.
It's one of those things you don't know it if you're eating it, but there's a little something. You've built a lot of layers of flavor.
A lot of layers. You have your sofrito, the meat, the pancetta, the wine is cooked out, the tomato paste is sticking to the pot, you have the bay leaf in there, and the nutmeg. Then I add 2 cups of stock, chicken stock I go for. Beef stock, not veal stock.
Again, something subtle.
Something subtle, and it's all about letting the ingredients kind of come together and shine and not have one take over. And so I go for chicken stock. If you make your own, that would be ideal. If not, go for a low-sodium version.
So can I just say one thing, which is, and I know this is not every state, but there's movement, I don't know, of a lot of good, quote-unquote, artisanal butchers these days. You see a lot in New York, from Fleischer's to Dixon's Farm Stand and all these places, where they all have really good stock in their freezer cases.
Oh, yeah.
You can buy a quart or a couple quarts, and it's so good to have. They got the good stuff. Take it home, leave it in your freezer, and then when you want to make bolognese a week or two later, you bring it out.
Exactly. They have the good stuff. It's going to be a little bit more expensive than the box stuff, but it's definitely worth it. So you're going to be adding 2 cups of chicken stock and then a cup of whole milk, which is pretty traditional.
Yeah.
You see, if there's any dairy in this recipe, it usually comes in the form of whole milk. I think cream or half and half is way too much. It's unnecessary.
I'm going to get to that in a second. All right. So at this point, this is I think where you and I differed a bit, because I think with the exception of the bay leaf, I'm like step by step with you.
Mm-hmm.
Got the milk, got the chicken stock. Put it on. It's all in a nice Dutch oven or whatever, over medium low heat.
Medium low. At this, medium low. You should basically see a bubble or two
every now and then,
and you're taking a wooden spoon, or if you have like a potato masher, and you're just mashing down on that meat every so often.
But what does every so often mean?
I'm like every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes. It's really just to break that meat up, and so it just becomes like little beads and develops this velvety texture. Mm.
So I'm more impatient than you are. I'm like, after an hour and 15 minutes, I'm like, this is good. Mm-hmm. Like, how much more can it get?
So when you add all the liquid, we say to cook uncovered so that the liquid can evaporate, and stirring occasionally until meat is very, very tender. So we say 2 to 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
We tried it at the 3-hour mark, and I don't think it was that much more special. But really the key to this is like for the meat to be tender and for a lot of the liquid to evaporate. You don't really want too much liquid. You want it to be almost what I describe as like a sloppy Joe texture in the end.
Yes.
Because you're going to be adding more liquid in the form of pasta water.
Okay, so let's get to that. So you've got this beautiful sauce, a couple hours on the stove. We're ready to eat. Or when you are ready to eat, you make sure it's warm. That's another thing where I think like in the old days you would see like a bowl of pasta and then they would spoon the sauce on top of the pasta and the pasta was all kind of stuck together.
We know better now.
Yes. So what's the way to do it? I have this big stock pot or Dutch oven of bolognese. How do I assemble the pasta itself?
So this is when you're marrying the pasta and bolognese. And by the way, once the bolognese reaches that kind of that sloppy Joe texture, I say, that's when it's ready, where either you assemble or you could just pack it up and freeze it.
Yeah.
So you have your pasta. And my preferred shapes are pappardelle, tagliatelle, or a short wide pasta like rigatoni. Pockery would also be good.
And those first two is also, if you're willing to spend the few extra dollars, there are a lot of those good like kind of fresh dried like egg noodle brands that you see out there that have like you'll see at places like Italy that are coming in the nice imported packages and the pasta is really yellow.
Yes.
And if you have tagliatelle or pappardelle, it's really nice to buy.
Go for that, and then whatever the package says, I would knock 2 minutes down. So if it says like however many minutes for al dente.
Say it says 10 minutes. You're saying do it at 8.
Do it at 8. Remove the pasta. Take about, we say, a cup of pasta water. Add that to the bolognese.
See, I'm going to do... All right, so what...
Tell me where you differ.
Or this is where I would differ in the sense that it depends. I might have this nice big pot of bolognese, but say I'm only serving maybe 2 or 4. Mm-hmm. I would take a couple of spoonfuls of the bolognese, put that in a saute pan, and warm that up. And then I would add the pasta water to the saute pan because maybe I don't want to put all of the pasta into the bolognese because I might not want some leftover bolognese. You know what I mean? I don't want... Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, but that's a very specific situation.
Well,
right?
No, it's not. But a lot of people are like, you aren't necessarily going to eat all of the bolognese.
If you're not going to cook all the bolognese, then set that aside, freeze, and do what you need. But in this case, you really...
Oh, so you're saying, okay, so maybe you're... Okay, I get you. This says 6 servings. If there's only 4 of you, take out a little bit from the bowl, from the pot, put that in a container, but still use... The big pot. Okay, gotcha.
Yes.
All right, so in goes...
The pasta water.
Over it, and then you turn the heat on.
And then, yeah, you turn the heat on, medium heat. You add some Parmesan, half cup, finely grated, like with a microplane.
Yeah.
Or using a box grater. And then I bring that to a simmer. Then I add the pasta.
Okay.
And then I let it go until it's al dente, and the sauce begins to cling onto the pasta, and it becomes just looks like... The dish that we all love and crave. And then from there, I don't finish with anything. I know a lot of our pastas finish with butter. I was taught to finish most of my pastas with butter. This is unnecessary. There's already a good amount of fat going on in this dish.
And cheese.
And cheese.
And that sort of like binds it in a way that sort of pulls it all together.
The Parmesan helps the sauce cling onto the pasta. So.
And it smells delicious. Well, the problem is this. Like, oh, this actually just says 4 servings. I was looking at our other bolognese recipe, which
this is four... Big servings. We're calling for a pound of pasta, but this is 4 very generous servings with probably some leftovers.
No, my thing is this: if the pasta is mixed in with the sauce, I'm gonna eat it. I'm not putting that in the fridge. There's no way that's getting in the fridge.
No, I don't want leftover. I don't like pasta. Something you got to eat right then and there.
Well, if the noodles are cooked, I'm eating them. I'm not gonna like rewarm it with the sauce because if I do. I love leftover bolognese, but I would rather go through that whole process of like warming it up, putting the pasta water in, fresh noodles, and that's great. But warming up leftover noodles already sauced.
It's never
good. All right. God, that's good. BA's best bolognese. You can find it on bonappetit.com. But you know what else you can find on bonappetit.com, Andy?
I have a feeling I know what you're going to say.
Cauliflower bolognese, which you developed for our Healthy-ish website at behealthyish.com. Go, if you're listening right now, listeners, obviously you are because you're listening, go to, cauliflower bolognese on Healthy-ish or Bon Appetit, and you look at this, and these are like rigatoni noodles with, this looks exactly like...
Right? It does.
Bolognese.
Yep.
Looks delicious. I can smell it and taste it, but there's no meat in there.
There's no meat at all. This is one of those recipes, Amanda Shapiro, the editor of Healthy-ish, she knows how I get. I can't sleep, and I'll start slacking her, what we use to message each other here at BA, or I'll text her and saying, like, I have this weird idea. It's like maybe making bolognese out of cauliflower. And she's like, okay. And she lets me do it.
Okay, but I would say this. Like, I can imagine this a dish being, like, when I was at college at Berkeley, one of my vegetarian friends would invite me over, like, oh, I'm making over this, like...
Yeah.
Cauliflower pasta. It's like bolognese. I'd be like, oh god.
Well, I'm a Berkeley boy, so
yeah,
I have
you,
it
you
in
are
me.
Too. Yeah. But you understand what good pasta is.
Yes.
So I'm going to trust you on this one. So you're kind of the same process. You're essentially subbing chopped up bolognese and mushrooms.
Yes,
for the meat.
Cauliflower.
Yeah, I mean
and
cauliflower.
Mushroom and substitute for the meat. And really, it's kind of I wanted to get the right texture and consistency and look. The flavor-wise, like, it's obviously not a meat sauce, so I wouldn't say that it tastes like a classic bolognese, but the way it looks and the texture of it, where it's the piece of the cauliflower almost mimics the meat in that sense. And that's done by pulsing the cauliflower in a food processor. I'm trying to remember that recipe because it was months ago. Do you have it in front of you, Adam?
Yeah, apparently you didn't print it out. You just
No, I just printed
I'm handing the laptop to Andy. He develops many, many recipes for Bon Appetit every month.
So I call for 12 ounces mushrooms. It could be shiitake or cremini, and then one head of cauliflower, which is about 2 1/4 pounds, let's say. And then I just kind of tear that up into florets, and I also pulse that until it's about like 1/4-inch pieces, which is kind of mimics ground beef size. And then from there, I'll work it in batches. You pulse the cauliflower, and then you heat oil, about 1/4 cup, and then you add the mushrooms, cook that down until they're golden brown and they shrink, and then I add one onion that's been finely chopped, and then I continue cooking that down until it's soft and golden brown. Then I add 6 garlic cloves that have been thinly sliced. Mm. It needs a lot of garlic since there's not a lot of other things
going on. There's no pork fat in
there. There's no meat fat yet.
But what I think is nice about mushrooms, and people talk about this a lot, like a well-browned mushroom is often people describe as meaty in taste.
Exactly.
It gets that nice roasty, deep flavor.
I think it does a lot to this dish. I mean, if it was just cauliflower, I think it would be fine, but I think the 12 ounces of mushrooms definitely gives it more substance.
And does the cauliflower then get browned also in the
cauliflower
fat?
Gets lightly brown. Uh-huh. It's not a deep, dark brown. Yeah. It doesn't caramelize that much. And then I add sliced garlic, dried chili flakes. I just think in this dish you need some kind of heat. And then 2 tablespoons finely chopped rosemary. And I cook that until the garlic is very soft.
Can we talk about the rosemary?
Oh, God. Okay. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I heard there were a few comments, and I myself am curious about the rosemary.
So I will say, what were the comments about the rosemary?
I don't know. You don't read the comments?
Oh, you're talking about the reader's comments. Yes. So I think some people are, you either love rosemary or you don't like rosemary. I don't think that's one of those. I think with this dish,
it's a confident herb.
Yeah, it's there. It's present.
Could you swap? Could I put thyme instead of rosemary or something?
I think thyme is more annoying than rosemary, picking those little leaves. It is. Like, I think you could use.
What about
thyme?
Oregano? Oregano is a very
absolutely.
Popular.
You know what? Yeah.
Can we put that in the recipe?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah. You can add.
I just find rosemary is a very piney herb, and I love it with lamb or something, but it's a lot.
That's fine. You could go ahead with oregano. I would use fresh oregano, not dried oregano, though. So you add that, and your pan is still pretty dry now. You have the onions, the mushrooms, the garlic, the chilies, the rosemary, and then I add tomato paste, 1/3 cup. That's, again, a good amount of tomato paste. One for the color, also for the umami and for acidity. I cook that down until it slightly darkens and again sticks to the pot, similar to a classic bolognese. And then I add the cauliflower that's been finely minced in a food processor. And I cook that. That takes about 6 to 8 minutes. It's going to release some steam and water. And you just want to cook that until the pan's really, really dry. Season that with salt. This dish can take a good amount of salt. And then that's kind of your base right there, this cauliflower mixture. It's still pretty dry. You're not adding any liquid to this because everything's pretty much cooked, and the liquid that you are going to add, it's going to be in the form of pasta water. So you have your pasta cooking. Again, I kind of went with the classic bolognese shape, so that's a rigatoni, tagliatelle, or pappardelle. I did rigatoni in this case. I cooked that for about 12 minutes, 2 minutes before it's al dente, and then add the pasta and pasta water. I add 1 cup pasta water and 2 tablespoons butter.
Yeah, because in your mind, you need the butter because you don't have the pork fat or beef fat.
You
need something lush.
It's not a lot of butter. You need that fat. Just one, it's just going to bring the sauce together. And already it's a very lean dish. You just don't have a lot of fat in it besides olive oil.
If you're vegan, would you just add some more olive oil then, I guess?
Yeah, I would add more olive oil. I mean, olive oil is as incredible as it is. It doesn't have that kind of magical effect like butter has with pasta. And then once you have the butter added to the pot with the pasta and pasta liquid, then you're just tossing constantly until the sauce begins to cling. I add a bit of Parmesan. Here, that also helps with the sauce to cling onto the pasta. And then that's when it's kind of ready to serve. And then I add a little bit of chopped parsley right before I start dividing among bowls.
Just something bright and fresh.
Just something to bring it back to life. Like, I think a little bit of chopped parsley goes a long way in this dish. And then plate it up, add a little bit more olive oil and more Parmesan, and call it a day.
When are we shooting our bolognese video? Have you shot that yet?
I haven't done that, but they've been telling me that I'm going to do it. I actually said no, like wait, and now right.
I'm coming on set for that one.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a really good dish.
All right, you can check out Andy's both of his bolognese recipes at bonappetit.com, BA's Beth Bolognese and Cauliflower Bolognese, and look for a video soon. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, Adam.
Okay, thanks to Andy Bergani, and now we have Emil and Emily talking wine. So, Emily Schultz, welcome to the pod.
Oh, thank you.
We're recording.
Wow, cool.
Emil.
Hi.
We're talking wine.
Wine.
The basically guide to wine.
The basically guide to wine.
Cheers to that.
Cheers to that.
Yeah. It's like 3 p.m. on a Friday. Good time for a glass of wine.
Great time for a glass of wine.
What are you guys drinking?
We are drinking a little pre-release of a wine called the Marigny that our friend Andy Young makes. This label's called St. Reginald's Parish from Oregon. And he's actually going to be in the pod a couple weeks from now, something like that.
And Emma just nodded. It'll be on in a future pod in a few weeks. But he's from like New Orleans, Louisiana, moved to Oregon.
Yeah, son of a preacher. Son of a Baptist preacher. Did not grow up
drinking
wine.
Don't give too much away.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
We'll keep it for the next spot. So this discussion is about some just basic tips for buying and drinking wine at home. I'm going to start off. I think I'm probably like a lot of people. I like to drink wine. I enjoy it at dinner. But when I walk into a wine store, I see this like whole wall of wine and I literally just freeze. I'm like, I don't, it all looks the same. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for me, you know, the thing that really helped me to turn a corner and feel less overwhelmed by like the crazy wide world of wine was picking one or two wine stores, ideally like near work or near my house, that I became a regular at. Instead of just going, you know, I used to, when I would buy wine, I would go to like all these different stores, whatever was closest, whatever was convenient. And, you know, every time you go in, you're looking at different wine. So if you have a couple of stores that you like, ideally places that are focused on wine, you know, if it's not too much to ask, a place that focuses on, you know, small and independent producers, not like big, you know, corporate wine, then you're going to walk in and you're going to all of a sudden you're going to get a bottle that you like, and then you're going to come back and you're going to see that bottle again. And you're gonna be like, oh yeah, that wine. And then you're also going to be able to, you know, come in, and maybe the people who work there are going to start to recognize you. Maybe you're going to have a conversation with them, and it's going to feel like less weird than like asking a stranger at a wine store every time, where you're going to find the light juicy reds or the like really crisp whites. You know, they come to know your taste, you come to know their taste. And more than one time I've like had a person at a wine store that I've been like, I don't talk to that guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't get me.
He doesn't get me.
But I think that's an interesting point about whether either close to where you live or close to where you work. That is, like, it doesn't have to, you're like, oh, yeah, that extra place is nearby. Like, Schultz, do you go to Chamber Street or where do you do?
All the time.
Which is a few blocks from here.
Yeah. I also think going off of that, following them on Instagram.
Oh.
What do you mean? Explain.
So, especially because, like, so much inventory is coming in and out, I find that a lot of the wine stores that do have those, like, small batch, limited release wines post on Instagram before they would, like, update their website or newsletter or anything like that.
I never even thought about a wine store having an Instagram account.
The only people I follow are, like, wine stores.
Really? So Schultz is like lined up outside of Chamber Street like Saturday morning at like 9 a.m. like a Supreme drop.
There have been times when I've DM'd wine stores like, can you just save me a bottle? I'm coming after work.
Wow.
So
that's a little, that's extreme. But
I also don't think it's extreme, because if you see something that, I don't know, has a cool label or the color is really pretty, you can kind of do some research on your own before you go into the wine store and learn a little bit about
that.
See,
that's good, because when you're at the wine store, sometimes, like I said, I have performance anxiety in the wine store. And like, oh, I got to be somewhere and I'm looking like, okay, I'll just grab that. Whereas if you have time on the way there to read up the wine.
I also think that following your favorite wine shop on Instagram is a good way to remind you that it exists.
True.
Too. Sometimes follow accounts on Instagram that I'm like, remember that brand exists because you meant to go to that store
or whatever.
You're like, yeah. Oh, right.
Wine. It's interesting you mentioned like the salespeople. There's a little wine shop near where I live on 8th Avenue in Chelsea, the Foragers Wine Shop. And it's nice in that there's not a lot to choose from, which I kind of like. You know,
totally.
It's not overwhelming. There's a couple of salespeople, and one of the guys, he sees me fairly often, And I'll ask someone about a bottle. He's like, oh, yeah, you'll like that one. Because he remembers that, well, if you like that, then you're going to like that. And that's similar to that. And he kind of like, they get you dialed in.
Totally. That's a dream. And, you know, a lot of places, if a lot of those kind of smaller, like cool boutique wine stores that are small and have like a limited, you know, manageable selection, a lot of them will have like loyalty programs and stuff like that. Yeah. Like a couple of stores that I go to where like, you know, you give your name and then you'll get points towards like a free bottle of wine or something like that. But they're also keeping track of what you've been buying. If you have like an account with them. So it's like, I'll be like, did I have this before? And they're like, oh yeah, you drank this like, you know, you bought this like 2 months ago. And you're like, I did like that. That was good.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. Let's say your wife, for instance, lives in Buffalo. And when you go visit the in-laws, John is drinking vodka on the rocks. Linda doesn't drink at all. So you've got to go to the wine store in suburban Buffalo where you don't know anyone. You're not familiar with the selection. Are there any sort of things I can use to sort of narrow the scope about what I should buy when you go to an unknown wine store with where you don't know the salespeople?
Well, I definitely think there are certain grapes that you can look for where you know they're going to be reliable, even if it's in a more corporate wine versus the small batch stuff that we gravitate towards.
What do you do in this instance if you're going to a bigger, more suburban store that doesn't have the cool indie wines? Like, what do you do?
Like, what am I going to buy?
Yeah, what are you looking for? How do you narrow your scope about, all right, I'm going to look at this, but not all this stuff?
I tend to go for red over white.
Interesting.
I find that some, like, the cheaper whites sometimes are too sweet for me. My mom really likes all those kind of, like, mid-Italy wines, so I usually do that because when I'm in these instances, I'm with her, and I find that those are always really reliable. But I'll usually just use like my own judgment over the people who work at the store.
Right. I feel often that's a case where I'm like, I don't think that I'm going to get what I'm looking for out of my like my customer service experience necessarily. So I do kind of go rogue. I mean, there are certain things that I look for, like Vino Verde, which is like dumb cheap. You know, it's like normally like $8 to $12 a bottle. It's like a slightly fizzy, it literally means green wine. It's like a slightly fizzy wine from Portugal, and it's low alcohol, it's super light, it's super bracing.
I like to describe that as the Sierra Mist of Portugal.
Wow.
It's just like you can just throw it back.
Yeah.
Portugal, if you need a new branding director.
And that, like, you could find that almost anywhere, and it's like gonna kind of over deliver.
Yeah. I feel the same about Gruner Veltliners from Austria, which come with the screw tops with the red and white top. I think those are super easy to drink with the whites. I have more problem with the reds in that sometimes I'm not sure, like, oh, like some, is it a 2011? Is that too old? Or like, I'm trying to figure out the vintages come into play more.
Yeah.
Do you have like a go-to red that you like to rely on, Emil?
I don't know. I mean, you were talking about Austrian wines, and I think increasingly you're seeing a lot of Austrian wines more widely available. So you were talking about Gruner Veltliner, which, you know, often comes in a liter bottle, often has like a crown cap, more like a beer cap. And those tend to be really affordable, crisp, bracing. Red-wise, Zweigelt.
Oh,
which
yes.
Which actually starts with an S or a ZW, Zweigelt. That's another Austrian wine that whenever I've been in kind of an unfamiliar liquor store and seen a bottle of that, I'm like, I'm going to give that a try. Because it's like, you know, in that kind of like light, drinkable, juicy red wine category. I mean, again, it's super hard to make those kinds of generalizations about wine, because it's like any grape can be made any way, you know, can be grown in a lot of different places, like different style, you know, like wines that come from a certain, it's hard to generalize about regions or grapes. You do what you can.
Yeah,
but
that's the tough thing about wines. Like, you, for the most part, you literally don't know until you've tasted it.
Right.
Whereas I can walk into a butcher shop, I can look at a steak and I can go, oh, that's a good looking steak.
Totally.
You know?
Totally.
Or the green market in the summer, you know, a good tomato kind of when you see it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say red wise also, just, we've talked a lot, we like Gamay in the sense, the grape from France, and just easy to drink, buy it relatively young vintage. It's not like a big wine that needs to age, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. I mean, I think the other thing that is important to note is that, like, if you're a person, you know, like the three of us who drink wine really regularly, every bottle that you buy, you're learning something about wine. You know, you're learning about, maybe you're learning about an importer that you really like, or maybe you're learning about a grape or a region, and, you know, you've got some kind of intel. Even if it's not a bottle that you love, you learn something.
Can we talk about importers? Because that's something that, not until I've been hanging out with you guys at Bon Appetit, did I ever even think to look at the back of the label to see who the importer is and what that might say about a wine.
Yeah, I think that's a little 2.0, but
let's just go there. It's
we're
Friday
going
afternoon.
There. So a lot of importers, especially in the wines that we at Bon Appetit like to drink.
And that being kind of that natural wine
that
world.
That natural
smaller
wine.
Producer.
Yeah, totally. Their name will be on the back of the bottle. And that's kind of how you can tell that it is a natural wine. For example, Zev Rovine is a big name producer, I guess, in New York City. And so
importer.
Big name importer.
Yes.
Yes, importer. You said producer. So Zev, who are some other names you guys mentioned?
Louis Dresner.
Uh-huh. Jenny and Francois.
Oh, yeah, Jenny and Francois. Mm-hmm. I hear them. Francois.
Selection Massal.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a record label. Like a cool indie record label. Like, oh, if you like Discord, then you'll probably, you know, that's
right. Well, I mean, I think that, yeah, and I think that analogy holds because, you know, again, when you're talking about just like narrowing the field, when you're just trying to figure out like what you like and how to get it, which I think is the real blockage for a lot of people around wine. When I started going into a certain kind of wine store and like going into a few different wine stores, another way that I further kind of narrowed that category is like, I'm like, oh, I love all of the wines that I've had that Jenny and Francois have imported. So, you know, Kermit Lynch. Yeah. Who's like the OG. And like,
so you can ask the wine store, like, hey, do you have any Kermit Lynch wines?
Yeah. You know, hopefully they would have something. But I mean, I've found that to go back to like, you know, being in, you know, a stranger in a strange land, like at the liquor store near my parents' house, I will look around and, you know, if I see a wine that's imported by Kermit Lynch, I mean, he's like a much larger in scale than some of the smaller guys we were talking about, but he has a commitment to, you know, certain kinds of wines and certain kinds of like farming practices and that kind of thing. So it's like, you just have a sense that it's going to be like a, you know, a tick or two better.
Well, I think it's interesting. You'd also talk about every time you have a wine, you learn something. And to your point, like following people on Instagram, like, the more you invest in it on your side, the more you get out of it. The more you remember things, the more you write things down, the more you save things on your Instagram account, that you'll then have that when you go into the wine store next time, you'll have that sort of battery of sort of info to draw on.
Right. And just like to be really clear, like nobody at Bon Appetit is like a wine expert.
Correct.
You know what I mean? We just like, you know, with the exception of Marissa A. Ross,
who's in California. Shout out, Marissa.
Shout out to Marissa.
She's listening to this right now, like rolling her eyes. She's like, oh my God.
Guys, will you shut that
you
up?
Total noobs.
But you know, it's like, I feel like for me, the moment that I got excited about wine was when I realized I didn't need to know everything about wine in order to drink it. I just needed to figure out how I could get the wine that I like to drink. And I've learned a lot in that time, but you know, I feel like most of what I've learned about wine is in the last like 3 years or so.
Okay, speaking of Marissa Ross, I think she does like an amazing job writing about wine in unexpected ways and using her very unique lingo to do so. But like when we walk into a wine store and we're talking to a salesperson, we do have to employ some of those like conventional wine terms. And I guess I'm just curious to you guys, like how do you communicate to a salesperson what it is exactly that you want from a bottle of wine?
Yeah, I like to start with the fruits that I really like, which I normally go towards those like summer berries. So talking about cherries or blackberries, really like ripe, juicy summer fruit, which normally can be found in those light gamays like you were talking about. Mm-hmm.
So and that's like in kind of contrast to like the kind of darker jam, like I feel like there's like fresh fruit and like cooked fruit.
Yeah,
you
totally.
Know, or like dried fruit.
Jammy,
you know?
As they like to say.
Yeah, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I also am inclined towards the
So my like Victoria Rappaport, my sister, like she loves a bottle of Merlot. Is that more on the jammy side of things, maybe? Or
Emil's
never had a glass of Merlot.
No, the first natural wine that I ever had that I loved was a chilled Merlot at Romans. And I was completely confused about like how to find wine like that.
Yeah.
I would go into stores and be like, do you have like a Merlot that you would serve kind of cold? Or like, do you have an unfiltered Merlot? I was just like, I had no idea like what the deal. And so like, yeah, like Merlot, I think the Merlot that your sister like normally drinks is probably on that kind of like inkier, darker fruit kind of spectrum.
Yeah, agreed.
And Mel, what about you?
Oh, what about me? Lingo-wise.
Yeah, lingo, like, yeah, what sort of terms do you throw around?
I think definitely like, you know, after fruit, I think I would want to talk about what's known as body, which is kind of like the texture of the wine. And like,
that's always confusing. What does that mean though?
Well, I mean, okay. Think about something that is kind of, you know, it's really like light and, or Yeah, light and heavy. You know, do you want that kind of wine that's going to kind of like really linger in your palate and feel kind of like a mouthful? You know, it's like...
Like a heavy Cab Sauv versus... Totally.
Or like in white wine territory, you think about like an oaky Chardonnay, you know?
Big.
Which is going to be like kind of have like a little bit more of like a mouth coating sort of quality versus something that you're like... Is it something that you're going to sit and sip and kind of ponder? Or do you... Which is... To me, how I think about kind of like a fuller bodied wine, or do you want something that's going to be like light and juicy and chuggable?
Yeah, I like that. So also, what about like tannins? Can I just tell someone like I don't want a tannic red? Like tannic is that kind of mouth dry sort of feel, which I can't deal with. Can I just tell the salesperson nothing tannic?
Yeah, I typically find that tannins and like that really heavy body are similar. So again, on that light Gamay front doesn't have as much tannins.
And tannins like are not a bad thing, you know, like that kind of drying quality you can get in like a range of like heft in a wine. It also helps to kind of like structure a wine sometimes, you know, like.
But if you say you don't want that super mouth drying thing happening, then
Yeah.
What about like acidity?
Well, I feel like that's like the sweetness and acidity are like two of the things that are like really closely linked and are really interesting. Like acidity, right, is like, you know, you think of acidity, you think about like lemon juice or like citrus. You think of kind of that kind of like puckery sort of like mouth-watering quality. And, you know, a wine can have a lot of acidity and that you experience that like, ooh, I'm like, I feel like I'm drinking lemonade, or I feel like I'm drinking like a wine that has a lot of tropical fruit flavors, like a white wine. You're thinking about like pineapple and citrus and whatever. Like that's definitely going to be like high acid. And then, you know, on the other side, but sweetness and acidity are always going to kind of be in balance. So you can have a wine that has a lot of acidity and also has some sugar in it, but you don't necessarily perceive the sugar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The same way that like lemonade, the more sugar you add, you know, at a certain point, it still tastes tart, but there's sugar there. And sweetness isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think that we kind of like have an inclination to like speak poorly of, or like assume that a sweet wine is made that way to appeal to kind of like a like lowbrow American consumer who just like wants sweet things. But there are a lot of like really delicious wines that have a little bit of what's called residual sugar in them. So that's just like from like leftover from the fermentation process. So a lot of like kind of off dry Rieslings, which can also be like nicely balanced and have some acidity, but also a little bit of sweetness.
But when if I say I want a dry white wine, does that mean I want that wine to not be very sweet?
I think it's about the perception of sweetness. If you want a dry white wine, that's going to be like, you know, if you want a bone dry wine, that you shouldn't really detect any sugar on the palate.
I want a grassy Sauvignon Blanc or something.
Sure.
All right, so let me ask you this. When you're at the wine store, how much are you thinking of what you're buying in terms of what you're going to be eating for dinner that night when you get home or when you get to your friend's house?
0%.
Really?
No, it's what I want to drink in that moment.
She's a maverick, folks.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're like, I'm drinking red even though we're doing this, or I'm just, this is what I'm in the mood for. It's a hot night. I'm buying this chilled bottle of whatever.
Yeah, like 100%.
I feel like people get so hung up on the wine pairing thing, and it's like, you know, having like elaborate charts and whatever about like what. But again, it's like, you know, I feel like it's such a complicated thing, and so many wines can go with so many different foods. And a lot of it has to do with like, do you like contrast? Do you want it to complement? Like, you know, it's like somebody might want to have like something, you know, acidic with an acidic dish. Somebody might want to have like something that's kind of darker and more ponderous with an acidic dish. So I feel like our answer to that is that, yeah, drink what you like with what you like.
I mean, it's interesting, like, you know, much has been made the last several years about rosé and like summer water and that sort of thing, and how people drink so much rosé in the summertime. And when people are drinking rosé in the summertime, they're not thinking about what it is they're ordering. They're just drinking rosé for dinner because it's hot out and they're outside. Totally. And whether it's steak or fish or pasta or whatever, like they're just throwing it back. And like there's no reason that same philosophy can't also apply to whatever else it is you like. I mean, I think the one instance maybe not is if you do have like a big oaky red wine and you're eating Branzino for dinner and it can just overpower it, perhaps.
Look, I mean, you're going to taste certain certain foods with certain wines and have an experience of that. And you're you're just learning. And it's if you are your sister and you gravitate towards dark, inky Merlots, and you have that, you drink that with everything you eat. You're just used to it. And then maybe, you're going to eat that with, drink that with fish. And that's not a proper pairing per se. But maybe you're going to like it. You're not. Maybe you're going to decide that you want to drink something different next time. Maybe you're going to decide you never want to eat fish
or
again.
You could just be like, I'm going to drink a light wine with this Branzino or halibut or whatever. And that light wine could be a red, could be a rosé, could be a white.
Yeah. I also think that my friends don't think about that. So my one bottle contribution isn't going to make or break it. So I don't really sweat the small stuff.
Do you mean that they have several bottles or you're bringing the only bottle of wine?
No, everyone is theoretically bringing a bottle of wine, but they're not thinking about, for example, I went to Wu's Wonton a couple weeks ago with them, which is a BYOB.
Wait, who is them? Who's your crew at this point?
Oh, these are my friends from college that live in New York.
Where'd you go to college?
Rochester Institute of Technology.
Oh, yeah, we talked about this.
Shout out to RIT.
RIT.
Oh, gosh, cold up there. Yeah, we went to Wu's and everyone brought a red wine, and I feel like in the world of Chinese food, you're supposed to drink, bubbly white stuff with dumplings and those fatty things and whites in general, but we had red wine and it was great and fun, and it's about the people you're with.
But I think it's also, if you want to think about what you're drinking and what you're eating, I think that's also, tasting, one wine and being like, oh, this tastes awesome. This red wine tastes awesome with this fish. This other one, I don't like it as much. Yeah. And then you get to, break it down and think about what it is about those wines that you like with what.
Yeah, if I'm going to have Peking duck, I want something to cut through that fat. And it could be a zippy red wine, or it could be something sparkling, or it could be like a white wine high in acid. Speaking of red wine, and you guys are drinking and bringing wine to dinner, is it me, or do most people drink red wine at the wrong temperature?
Yeah, red wine is too damn warm.
I mean, right?
I mean, it is really.
Sometimes my roommate will put her open red wine in our little credenza that we keep alcohol in, and I'll sneak it into the fridge later because I'm like, you can't do this.
I mean, right. I think people have this fundamental misunderstanding that red wine is supposed to be drank at room temperature.
Yeah.
And room temperature, if room temperature is cellar temperature,
but room temperature is 68 degrees.
Probably, I really hope that people's apartments are not 55 degrees.
Yeah.
And I just made that number up, so I'm not sure if that's the exact temperature. But to me, you still want red wine to be cool to the touch.
Sorry. So say buy a bottle of wine, red wine, off the shelf in a liquor store, bring it home on the subway, get home half hour later or whatever, by the time I'm home. And what should I do with that bottle before we sit down to eat?
Dude, honestly, most of the time with reds, I'll pop them in the freezer for 15 minutes or something.
Okay.
30 minutes is going to get you white wine cold, mm-hmm. where you want that. But 15 minutes is going to take a little bit of that kind of subway body heat warmth off of it. So that, when you pour into the glass and you touch it, when you take a sip of it, it's going to taste, it should taste cooler than your mouth. It shouldn't be blood temperature,
And also, as you're eating and the wine sitting there in the glass and you're holding the glass, it's going to warm up. The bottle will also warm up.
Yeah. Realistically speaking, I don't have more than three or four bottles of wine in the house at any given time. But I will keep my red wines in the fridge. And maybe that's sacrilege. But I keep my red wines in the fridge and then I take them out of the fridge maybe a half an hour before dinner, before I want to drink them.
Is that what you do, Schultz?
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like, in terms of that kind of I really want to drink this wine now, but it's too warm. I would rather take it out of the fridge and drink a glass that's a little too cold than
absolutely.
Drink a glass that's a little too warm and then have it in the, in the fridge or the
also,
freezer.
Also, and I'm not going to purport to understand how to keep a wine stable and this and that and cellar temperature and store it, but it's I know at least, in most places in this country in the summertime, when I'm at work, the air conditioning is not on in my apartment. Mm-hmm. And the apartment gets hot. And I'm thinking if I have a bottle there all day long in a hot apartment, then it cools down at night, then it gets hot again during the day. Leaving a bottle of red wine out for a month in August is probably not a good idea.
Yeah, probably not.
Better just keep it in the fridge.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and, you know, if you're a person who, like, buys a lot of wine, buys cases of wine, like, whatever, you want to have a place in your house, probably, you're probably not doing that in your apartment, where you can keep wine at a regulated temperature and avoid those kind of swings. But that's really, you know, at the end of the day, that's really more of a concern for somebody who's, like, collecting wine.
Yeah.
You know, if you're like most of us and you have maybe, like, six bottles of wine kicking around, you probably have room in the fridge.
You're trying to say they're the types who are probably not reading the Basically Guide to Wine and this much Bon Appetit.
They're probably listening to this and they're like, "What? I can't believe they're saying that."
How dare you?
Don't worry, they turned it off several minutes ago. Before we let you go, Schultz, what are you drinking tonight?
Oh, actually, one of my favorite wines, which is a Chilean Carignan, and it's from Villalobos in Chile. It's these people who found this wild bush of Carignan grapes and then made a winery.
One bush?
I don't know. There was like a lot. They showed us photos. Were you there?
Oh, yeah.
Around wine, yeah.
Oh, that guy.
Where
will you be partaking in this wine?
Alex Delaney's house.
Oh, Alex Delaney.
Come over if you want.
Maybe I will. And you, Emil?
You know, I don't know if I'm drinking wine tonight, but I really have a craving for some daiquiris. So proper, not a frozen daiquiri, people. Just
the classic
lime juice, like simple syrup.
Oh, okay.
Rum. I want
to. I thought you were going to the tropics tonight.
Getting all Hemingway on us.
No, but you know, it's like during the wintertime, that's all I want to drink. I just want to drink like sours. I want to drink
never think of that.
Ice cold, like lime juice cocktails. That's what I want. It's just a margarita, but with rum.
I'm going to go to the gym because Emma and I had a big power lunch today.
And I was like, nobody asked me
what I was going to ask you.
I'm going to have to work off the power lunch, go home, make some dinner. I'm going to feel like that night where nice. I like staying at home on a Friday night.
Me
and
too.
Just like, I've been around people and working all week. Just like come home,
people
open a
worst.
Bottle of kind of say something like Gamay-ish, chilled, semi-chilled red.
Cool.
Semi-chilled kind of life.
Yeah. Semi-chill. Can we start a new wine podcast called Semi-Chill, Emma?
Semi-chilled kind of life.
Yeah. Well, no, we'll make a wine that's like a light-bodied red.
A wine that is in sync with the podcast and an Instagram account.
In sync's a different band.
Ooh.
Emily Schultz, thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Rappaport.
Thanks, Bill.
Anytime.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.